From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Without question, should something happen to me, Representative Tracy can guide this state and guide it well from the governor's chair. She has the legislative experience and the business experience to know how things operate and work in Springfield. But more importantly, Jill understands how things ought to work in Springfield.
Throughout the summer, Senator Dillard was looking for the right mix of talent and skills to fill his team. Today, I gratefully thank Senator Dillard for his confidence in me, and I proudly accept his offer to become his lieutenant governor.
And we heard there State Senator Kirk Dillard, a Republican from Hinsdale, who is one of the Republican candidates for governor, as he announced his running mate for the gubernatorial primary, his lieutenant governor candidate, Jill Tracy, a Republican state representative from Quincy. This is as we go through an election cycle for the first time in Illinois where the candidates have official running mates in the primary, so they are forever linked. Also on the show today, those state capitol doors. They've opened, and what we've seen inside is a can of worms. That's all ahead on State Week. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel today, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Brian Mackey, State House reporter for WUIS Illinois Public Radio. And our guest this week, Dave McKinney, State House reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. And welcome to the show today, Dave.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
And as we heard at the beginning, I don't know if most people across the state call it a momentous announcement when somebody announces a running mate for lieutenant governor, but Kirk Dillard made it official this week, as has Republican candidate Dan Rutherford, who is selected Steve Kim of Northbrook, I believe, is his running mate. If I'm wrong on that town, please correct me. And so far at this time, when we record this show, those are the only two candidates who have announced their running mates for lieutenant governor. So we're part of a new mix. It does give political writers something to write about in the late summer, Dave.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, these are two, well, I mean, I think there's the old mantra that these lieutenant governor picks never really help the gubernatorial candidates. You just don't want them to hurt them. And I think in picking Kim and in picking Tracy, those are both safe picks. I mean, for Dillard, he picks a downstate woman who has held some plum committee assignments. She was on the Blagojevich committee. She's on the pension conference committee. And she's respected in the chamber as an intelligent veteran legislator. And, you know, on top of that, it doesn't hurt that she comes from a downstate media market. So I think for him, that's good. It balances out his suburban background. For Rutherford, he picks an Asian American, and it's true to form for him, where he, you know, at the state fair was talking about thinking that the winning ticket for Republicans this year is to reach out to different ethnic groups and Asian American voters, while not probably the most powerful ethnic group in Illinois. You know, have not been represented in state government particularly well over the years, never had a statewide candidate. I don't believe there's ever been one elected in the House or the Senate. So, you know, that fits with Rutherford's campaign theme. So we've got the other candidates out there still kind of up in the air, and, you know, I expect more announcements to be coming in the next week or two.
And we should maybe back up just a minute and explain why this is a sort of a different way to go about this. They're picking their lieutenant governor candidates this time because of a change in the law. Previously, people would run independently for that office, and then you would get paired up after the primary election. And that's led to situations just 4 years ago or 3 years ago where Scott Lee Cohen, who was a pawnbroker and had some other scandals come out from his past, managed to win the Democratic primary, and then Democratic power brokers kind of urged him to step aside, which he did, and ended up running independently for governor, which is another story. But you can get into sort of trouble with this, and I'm sure Charlie can speak a little bit about what happened with the LaRouches in the 80s and caused the Democratic gubernatorial nominee to renounce his own party and run as a third party candidate. So, I mean, this is a pretty big change to have this sort of adopt the presidential style, picking the vice presidential candidate, now it's the lieutenant governor candidate here in Illinois, and run as a team into the primary.
Yeah, it's and in a sense, Brian, you alluded to what happened back in 1986, and so this change is maybe a quarter of a century overdue. And back then, what happened was the Democratic Party workers and the media kind of were asleep at the switch, and so this slate of people who was aligned with Lyndon LaRouche, who was, I think it would be fair to say, is kind of a strange duck with a lot of strange opinions. Two of his followers managed to win nominations for the Secretary of State and for Lieutenant Governor. And because after the primary, the Lieutenant Governor was linked to the governor, the Democrats' gubernatorial primary winner, Adlai Stevenson, resigned the nomination and ran on a third party rather than have the chance that the LaRouche lieutenant governor, a guy named Mark Fairchild from Rockford, might, through some terrible misfortune, become governor of the state. And the irony was that Stevenson barely lost to Jim Thompson 4 years earlier. I think the final vote result was like 5,074 votes. And so the Democrats saw their chances kind of wither away. And part of it was, as I say, the media kind of figured these guys are wackos. We don't have to pay any attention to them. And I was part of the media at the time, so I'm blaming myself as well. But the party workers thought that they could just mail it in. And you had two LaRouches, a guy named Fairchild running against a guy with kind of an ethnic-sounding name, George Sangmeister, who was at the time a state senator. And you had the woman named Janice Hart, who was LaRouche for Secretary of State, running against Aurelia Puchinsky, again an ethnic-sounding name. And in the reportage that came out after this, and I talked to a lot of downstate party people, and they said, well, we think that the voters voted for the people who had kind of the all-American names because they didn't know who any of them were. And so you would have thought back then the Democrats would have said, okay, we had this disaster. Democrats controlled the General Assembly. They could have passed legislation linking the two before the primary, but it took Scott Lee Cohen to finally get them off the dime.
After
it's interesting if that law had been in place, Charlie, you know, you have to wonder if Pat Quinn would be governor today, because I don't know that Rod Blagojevich necessarily would have chosen Pat Quinn to be his running mate.
No, I think it's a pretty safe bet that he wouldn't have.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dave. And I think, kind of echoing what was alluded to earlier, I think it's one of those instances that shows just how much damage a wrong lieutenant governor candidate can do for you, whereas it doesn't help you. It can only hurt you. So it's probably good that they get linked up with somebody of their choosing a little bit earlier on.
Well, and we should.
Kind of the history of the lieutenant governor, it's kind of strange because at the time of the Constitutional Convention, the lieutenant governor ran independently in the general election as well. And in 1968, voters chose Dick Ogilvie, a Republican, to be governor, and Paul Simon, a Democrat, to be lieutenant governor. And there was all kinds of consternation of what would happen. And back in the day, when the lieutenant governor or when the governor was physically out of the state, if the governor went to St. Louis or went to Minneapolis or somewhere, the lieutenant governor became acting governor. And so there was concern that if Ogilvie were to leave Illinois, Simon would come in and undo all of Ogilvie's stuff. And both Ogilvie and Simon were people of the highest integrity, and they said early on, no, that's not going to happen. Simon said he would not poach on the governor's territory if the governor were to be out of state. But to avoid that, the decision was made that in the future, the lieutenant governor and the governor would run as a team in the general assembly, in the general election. And so the first time out of the box in 1972, you get a maverick Democrat elected governor, Dan Walker, and he had as his running mate Neil Hartigan, who was a member of the Daily organization who had been at loggerheads with Walker. So you wound up with a situation where the governor and the lieutenant governor were in greater conflict than they had been when one was a Republican and the other was a Democrat. So now maybe we've got to the point where we'll have everybody on the same page from the get-go. Of course, there are also constitutional amendments pending that would do away with the lieutenant governor's office altogether. So maybe this will be the last hurrah for that post.
Well, I believe Jill Tracy is one of the advocates of that. Am I correct?
I think so.
Yeah.
And I also noticed now we will be hearing candidates pointing out that what the role of their lieutenant governor may be. Besides filling in for them, they will kind of dish out that special assignment. I think jobs will be the focus under Dan Rutherford's administration if he were to be elected.
And yeah, he said he would put Steve Kim in a position, create a new position to sort of focus on the economy and jobs. It made me wonder why not just sort of say you'll make your lieutenant governor the DCEO director, for example, the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. It's interesting that, you know, you talk about, Charlie was referring to how some of these candidates have not gotten along too well in the past. And there's certainly back when it was Governor Blagojevich and Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn, there did not appear to be a close working relationship between them. Quinn just pretty much did his own thing. He traveled to a lot of military funerals, and he would have a few little areas in which he was interested, but you didn't hear a whole lot from him on a statewide basis. And then once he was elevated to governor, he got to pick Sheila Simon last time around, which is sort of interesting. It was sort of a dry run for what everybody's going to be doing this year because of the whole Scott Lee Cohen debacle. And so now, yeah, we're going to see, I think that the candidates are going to be much more closely judged by who their lieutenant governor picks are, and there remains an opportunity for mischief and revelations, and we'll find out if anything comes of that.
You know, a little footnote there, maybe this belongs at the end of the show, but I tracked down Dave O'Neill, who was the running mate of Jim Thompson for, I believe, a couple of years back in the late 70s. Charlie, you remember him. He was one who famously said that, you know, that job is worthless. And it's interesting that, you know, you fast forward 30-some years and Dave O'Neill, you know, a man in his late 70s and in the sunshine of Arizona, still says that job is worthless.
Well, he quit.
Yeah.
Midway through the second time.
Did Dave O'Neill think it was a good idea that candidates get linked at the hip now in the primary at all?
Well, you know, I don't recall asking him that question, Bill. I was just more thinking about I was tracking him down about the question of about abolishing
the
job, you know, and of course he was all for that.
And as we look ahead, the other candidates have to come up with their candidates, their lieutenant governor candidates. Governor Quinn, what do you anticipate him doing? I know we won't necessarily be able to come up with that name, but do you think it will certainly be somebody in the city of Chicago as he appears to try to coalesce votes in Democrat-heavy Cook County?
I mean, there's a number of different ways he can go here, right? And it's interesting, we've talked about the people who have been named so far do sort of play into the message that the candidates are trying to say about themselves. So somebody mentioned that Rutherford talked about needing to broaden the reach of the Republican Party. He goes with an Asian American. Kirk Dillard has talked about how he worked. He has this talking point he likes to use that he worked for the last competent and honest governor, Jim Edgar. He was his chief of staff. And so he has chosen somebody who's a sort of insider here in Springfield who has, as Dave said, is well-respected, has had a lot of important committee assignments. So what message is Governor Pat Quinn going to try and tell? It's not clear yet. There has been speculation that he would go with an African-American person to shore up that community, that base of voters that he really needs to tap into if he wants to try and win the primary in the election. There, you know, he could try and go with somebody downstate. He doesn't seem to have a lot of inroads down here. We're still waiting to find out.
I don't know. I think for Quinn, an African American female veteran
from downstate.
I think that would fit all the profiles. Yeah.
You're listening to State Week. The sidewalks to the state capitol may not be paved in gold, but the cost of copper doors is getting attention just ahead.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and the Chicago Sun-Times' Dave McKinney. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Dave, you've been among the reporters covering some of the remodeling at the state capitol, and some of the dollar amounts are catching attention. And the stories now have allowed you to be on various talk shows. So if you want to give us a little background and take us into the copper door story.
Well, I mean, it's a $50 million project here that is nearing completion. They have turned the west wing of the Capitol into a beautiful building. I mean, it's the painting in there, the artistry. It's clearly, you know, you walk in and you're wowed by it. But with all of that comes a hefty price tag. And you know, for we reporters who were sitting in the Stratton Building, due west of the Capitol, you know, when it didn't take long when they took the wraps off these copper plated doors for all of us to look out our windows and catch the glare of the sunlight off of them and ask what in the world is that about. And you know, we saw about 2 weeks ago the Capitol architect Richard Alsop took the press corps on a tour of the West Wing, and we got to look at those a little bit closer, as well as what was going on inside. The three doorways for the part that we're talking about here, they've outfitted with these specially crafted doors that are aimed to sort of fit in with the historical flavor of this building that opened in the late 1800s. They cost a combined $669,000, and I think if you ask anybody out there, especially at a time when the state can't pay $7 billion in bills to vendors and faces $100 billion in unfunded pension liabilities, it became a bit of an optics problem, I think, for the people who have been, you know, the legislative caucuses, really, that have been driving this construction over there. And so, there's not been a real favorable response from what we've heard. I mean, Governor Quinn called them excessive. Dan Rutherford, whose office is in that wing, along with others, I mean, the press corps and House and Republican staffers and some senators and reps, Rutherford called the doors inappropriate. And really, it's a bit of an unknown where the doors came from and who ordered them and who put them there. I mean, you know, we know that the architect had a hand in that, but I don't know who gave him the okay. No one's really been able to tap into that and figure that question out.
And it does, as you mentioned, it comes at a time of state budget problems, and it's created a perception. It might not be the most egregious of state spending, but you certainly see how this story has caught fire in a way, because it is one of those issues somebody can relate to. Now we see it even Candidate Daley has kind of slammed Candidate Quinn for allowing it to happen under his watch.
Well, and that's kind of gets at what Dave was talking about. Who, I mean, the governor is, you know, he's based in Chicago. He doesn't live in Springfield. I don't know. He famously said he would keep his underwear in the mansion. I don't know if he does that, but he does spend a lot of time in Chicago. He was here, however, during session. All the lawmakers are here during session. Presumably, they are checking in on this renovation. I mean, somebody's responsible for it. I don't know that we can put this on the architect. I find it hard to believe that he himself would have the authority to make this kind of call or would not have checked it out. I mean, his goal, as he stated to us pretty plainly, is to try and capture the vision of the original architect from the late 1800s. And so he, spared within his budget. He spared no expense to do that. And I think you can see, Dave pointed out there are some really neat touches in there. The exit signs have sort of an old-timey font on them. So they look like, even though they are modern, safety-compliant exit signs, they look old-fashioned. I mean, they really did. The detail work is incredible. I kind of liked what Mark Brown had to say, one of Dave's colleagues at the Sun-Times. He had talked about making an impassioned defense to his colleagues of the renovation of the state capitol building, because it is a public building. It's a beautiful building. It's a national landmark. It's a historic building. But when you hear about something like this, and as another columnist, the State Journal Register here in Springfield, Dave Bakke, put it, each of those doorways are worth more than his house. And when you put something like that, that's just the kind of thing that catches fire with the public imagination, I think, and gets people who are already primed to be upset about state spending and the pension problems and the backlog of bills. It just makes them all that much more angry, I think.
Yeah, because
and
you
Dave,
can't
you
really
even reported it was worth more than a house on sale in the Barrington area, if I recall.
Well, yeah. You know, again, Brian hit it on the head. Your imagination just goes wild. I mean, I punched in that price tag and up popped an executive house, 5 bedrooms, 4 baths, a 4-car garage. I could easily live in about, you know, 1/10 of that house. And you know, it just, what the problem here with this, it, you know, in terms of the overall financial state of Illinois, I mean, this is like the eyelash on an elephant. I mean, it really is not that big of a deal expense-wise, but you can't, you know, the legislature, the governor, all of these people can't be preaching austerity, and they can't be preaching the need to cut back on Medicaid and cut back pension benefits because, you know, the state's aflame. They can't be making those arguments, and yet, you know, allow the spending like this to go on as it did. I mean, I think Mark's point, as Brian alluded to, Mark's point is that, you know, the Capitol is the most beautiful public building in Illinois. I would say that without doubt. And it deserves to be nice. And, you know, I think, you know, the whole point in doing this really was that, you know, you had a heating and cooling system that didn't work, a fire alarm system that didn't work, a wing that lacked adequate safeguards to get people out of there in the event of a fire. I mean, those are the kinds of things that really drove this. But then they figured that while they had the whole place gutted, why not make it look nice? And again, you know, a fellow that gets quoted quite a bit, a financial watchdog, Lawrence Massal with the Civic Federation, made the point that, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing those core issues on this building right now. But, you know, when was it ever publicly discussed what exactly this building was going to look like and the scope of it and all these changes? And that's the bit of the unknown here. It seems like it's been very tightly controlled, and you know, the public now is just seeing it. It seems like, you know, the PR rollout of this has had some problems.
And where I find myself as an ordinary citizen conflicted here is, as someone who has spent time in that building, I do want to see preservation efforts, and I do like to see restoration efforts. And people that come in will always notice how great the dome looks from the inside. Well, 30 years ago or so, and Charlie, you can probably back this up, it didn't look so good. It was black. It was covered from smoke from the years and dirt. And Governor Thompson at that time led the way to get that cleaned up and improved. And those kinds of things are important for a historic building. But then, as someone who's also seen state government in action, you got to think, even with those doors, they probably could have gotten a better price.
Well, and consider too, Bill, that there are two other entrances that, you know, presumably at some point are going to be outfitted with these same doors, although that decision has not been made. And then there are a couple of doors on the side of the north wing. So, I mean, you know, it's conceivable that you could be talking, once this is all said and done at this Capitol, you could be talking about spending close to $2 million on these exterior doors. And that's a stunning amount of money to spend on doors.
And, Charlie, you have any thoughts you want to add into this conversation? You have been inside that building much of your life.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've been in and out of that building for, Lord, probably close to 50 years, or actually more than that. I think it was the mid-60s when I first went in. It is a magnificent building. It is absolutely beautiful. And every day I walked in there to go to work for the Sun-Times in the State House Bureau, I just marveled at what a gem it is. And I'm thinking to myself, on the one hand, yeah, that's a lot of money to spend for doors. But on the other hand, those doors will still be there, you know, long after all of us are gone. And it's in keeping with the other restoration that's been done. The House Chamber was restored to look kind of the way it was in the late 1800s. And they did restoration up on the 1/4 floor, and they uncovered a room that had been basically forgotten. It had been boarded up, and there were beautiful murals in there depicting Civil War scenes. And so those are the kind of things that it's a lot of money, but on the other hand, this is something that will be there literally for decades and decades to come, and it adds to the overall quality, the overall beauty of this architectural gem that we have here in Springfield.
And now, time for notes from the field. I'll start with Brian Mackey.
So we have been Chief Justice Thomas Kilbride of the Illinois Supreme Court. His term is going to be expiring in October here in Illinois. The Chief Justice serves for a 3-year term from among the 7 members of the court. And there's always a bit of a parlor game among court watchers to see who will be the next chief. It usually goes by seniority, but there are other factors that occasionally come into play. There's an upstate downstate rotation. So I've been kind of sniffing around to see, try and figure out who it would be. Earlier this year, I happened to notice that they were taking portraits of Justice Rita Garman in the center bench of the court. And then later, just this past week, I happened to see that the Chicago and Women's Bar Associations have sort of perhaps prematurely announced receptions in honor of the new Chief Justice Rita Garman. So that was enough for me to go on with the story. So it does appear, the court has not formally announced it yet, but that Chief Justice will be Rita Garman beginning in October. It's notable she would be the second woman to be the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, and in fact, the second woman to head one of Illinois' 3 branches of government.
Dave McKinney.
Well, I don't know. I guess I would go by the numbers here and relate back to our discussion about lieutenant governor candidates. Steve Kim, in the last election cycle in 2010, he accrued more than 1 million votes when he ran against Lisa Madigan, but that wound up being a percentage, I think, of 32%, which was the poorest of any Republican nominee on that ticket. So I went digging, and over the last 10 years, we've seen some statewide Republican office holder or candidates who have done actually more poorly than that, if you can believe that. I mean, Stuart Umholtz in the 2006 race against Lisa Madigan had in the mid 20s, and Steven Sauerberg, who ran against Durbin, he was also in the 20s. So anyway, I was just sort of curious, you know, at 32%, where does that rank? And it's a pretty poor number, but it wasn't the worst.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the economic reports have come in for the month of August. The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability report that came out earlier this week showed that the state's general funds grew by roughly 9.5% in the first 2 months of fiscal 2014. And that comports with a report from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois in Urbana, where its flash index, which is kind of an instant barometer of how the economy is doing, shows that Illinois is continuing to grow economically, but at a virtual snail's pace. The index was 106.5 in August, which is the same as it was in July, and that is the highest that the index has been, though, since July of 2007. So we're growing, but not at as fast as we would like to see.
And I have one as well. Livingston County, Illinois, led the way in the nation in the drought payments, crop insurance payments that farmers received. Farmers in that county alone, $154 million for the drought of 2012. 3 other Illinois counties cracked the $100 million mark. 7 of the top 10 counties in the nation for crop insurance were in Illinois. Farmers in Livingston County paid in $9 million. The taxpayers paid in $11 million for the insurance, and then taxpayers covered a good chunk of the $154 million. That's all the time we have for this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.